Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Colin Mustful, your host today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. William Green, author of the book, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. Dr. Green, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. William Green is professor of history at Augsburg University and vice president of the Minnesota Historical Society. In addition to his newest book, The Children of Lincoln, Green is the author of Degrees of Freedom, The Origins of Civil Rights in Minnesota, 1865 to 1912, winner of the Hognander Minnesota History Award, and A Peculiar Imbalance, The Rise and Fall of Racial Equality in Minnesota, 1837 to 1869. Dr. Green, as we get started, I'd like to hope you could give our readers a little bit of perspective. In your introduction, you stated that before writing this book, you made the mistake of, quote, superimposing the traits of a 21st century liberal on the liberal of the 19th century, assuming that those in the past shared the present sense of Minnesota exceptionalism, and I was wrong to do that, unquote. I wonder if you can help your readers avoid this same mistake by putting the actions or inactions of the people you highlight in this book in the context of the time period in which they lived.
Well, I'll try. When I first looked at the history, I was impressed with the lead that Minnesotans took in First of all, protecting the Union. Minnesota was the first state to send volunteers into the army upon Lincoln's call to arms. Minnesota was the first to respond. Minnesota would also become one of the first states to extend black suffrage by vote. It would ask the voters of Minnesota, who are all white men, in the wake of the Civil War, whether they wanted to extend the right to vote to blacks, and they did, and it was the first state to actually do that. In 1869, Minnesota also the legislature passed a law that would ban school segregation on the basis of race, and would take the next step to have blacks serve on the jury, on juries. That is something that hadn't happened before in the state and in many states in the North. So Minnesota had reason to feel that it was on the right side of history. But what happened after 1870 really sort of was very telling of just how exceptional Minnesotans were. Because in the wake of 1870, after the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were ratified, throughout the North, and the National Party of the Republican Party basically abandoned the African American. And in the South, was the rise of white supremacy. In Minnesota, you don't see the rise of white supremacy, and you don't see the same kinds of violence being committed against the black population. And so when the United States Senator Morton Wilkinson said that we have done our part, I took that to mean that we have done, we meaning the white leadership of the state, the white people of the state, had done what we morally should do for our black neighbors, but that we were there to back you up when and if you needed us in the future. That was my assumption. Mm-hmm. What I later came to realize was that once the political equality had been established for African Americans, the general mood of white friends of black people in Minnesota was, now that we've given you this right, you're off on your own to either fall or to succeed on your own. And so there was a different kind of abandonment of the African American. With the establishment of black political rights, black equality in the political sphere, there was not much consideration for whether blacks should have the same opportunity to purchase farms, for example, or develop skilled trades, become skilled laborers, or even to succeed in the schools or to live where they wanted to live. There was really not much consideration on the part of white friends to secure those kinds of opportunities. And I think even more fundamental than that, there was very little regard given to whether blacks and whites should even socialize together. Mm-hmm. It was only the existence of the ballot to the black man that the friends of Lincoln were most concerned with. And the presumption that once that had been established, then they could pretty much feel that they've done all that they should do for the African American. So that's what I learned. And you learn that from the larger context. You still see the existence of black isolation, of Jim Crow laws, of discrimination, of violence that could appear on the streets between white men and black men, and that the friends of black people basically kind of said nothing about it. They looked in another direction. That was the kind of reality that I had to get used to. Mm-hmm. So adjusting my eyes to a much more nuanced, subtle form of race relations was what I had not done and had to learn to do when I began to write that final draft.
You mentioned Morton Wilkinson in a statement he made, "We have done our part." When did he say that, and how does that relate to this book that you've written?
Well, Wilkinson was the first Republican U.S. senator for the state. He was elected in 1859. His tenure would begin in 1860, and it would straddle basically the Civil War. His term would end in 1865, and he had been a champion of African American equality. He was considered a radical Republican. In my view, he was one of the more radical of radical Republicans, and we can talk more about that part later on. But the key thing is that he spoke as one of the keynote speakers at the convention celebrating the passage of black suffrage in Minnesota in 1869. This is for the state constitution. And he used the phrase, "We have done our part." Namely, you know, we led white voters who may have been apprehensive to support black suffrage. We led them to the ballot, to the question, and persuaded them to vote for black suffrage. And in doing that, we've done all that we can and should do to give you opportunity to do better. So it was within that context when he uttered that language. So it occurred once again in 1869.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about Wilkinson. You mentioned that he was the first to make President Lincoln aware of the outbreak of war with the Dakota in Minnesota in 1862. And he seemed very much opposed to the rights of the Dakota people, yet he was in favor of the rights of blacks and black suffrage. Can you talk a little bit about that dichotomy in his thinking?
Yeah, that was he pretty much reflected the attitudes of a lot of people like him who supported black emancipation and black political equality, but harbored resentment and in some cases even hatred of the Native American. He was from New York, New York State, and had never really had any kind of actual exposure to to Native Americans until he moved to Minnesota, and so he brought with him when he settled in Minnesota the sort of romantics notion of the noble savage that he got from James Vannevar Cooper's novels and whatnot. And that's not unusual for a number of the liberals who moved to Minnesota in the 1840s and 50s. But in time, he developed an antipathy for the natives, and it was sparked principally in 1862. Wilkinson had moved to Mankato. Mankato was very much in the midst of that region where the Dakota were at war against the U.S. government and white farmers. And his family was still in Mankato, so he felt especially threatened. Because he came from a state that was identified as a state with a huge Indian population, he was pretty much appointed to the committees in the Senate that dealt with Indian affairs. And he felt that he was a person who had made sure that the interests of Indians were taken care of. He had taken on a fairly paternalistic view of the Indians, so that in 1860 and the Indian system, which was what the Indian Department was called, was rife with corruption, and so a lot of the good efforts that I think Wilkinson felt he was committing never was really seen by the Indians who were supposedly in his charge. And so when the Dakota rose up in 1862, he had this sense of them being ungrateful for all of his good deeds. And this triggered this intense antipathy. First of all, his family was threatened. He felt fearful of their well-being, living in Mankato at the time, and also the sense of the Indians in general and the Dakota in particular being ungrateful for, quote, all the good things that he had done in their behalf. And so he felt that they needed to be punished. And his first interest was in seeing a policy that would institute extermination that would exterminate the Dakota, and he would later see it as an opportunity to have the Indians removed, and in doing so, free up all of that valuable land that could be used for homesteading. Mm-hmm. He could move the Indians out. So Wilkinson, as a result of his relationship to Indian policy, sort of transformed. While being on one hand a person who was frustrated with Lincoln for not prosecuting the war more aggressively and for not pushing for emancipation more urgently, and for wanting to see blacks serve in the army and wanting to have resources available for the family of slaves who were serving in the army, he was very progressive in that regard. Mm-hmm. From those stances, he had this very personal sense of frustration and anger for people who he felt had let him down. And so he could be pro-black on one side and anti-Indian all at the same time. That's not unusual. As I said before, Jane Grey Swisshelm, a noted journalist, then living in St. Cloud, was also an abolitionist and very much frustrated that Lincoln was not prosecuting the war to end slavery enough, but quickly enough. But she also quickly came to embrace the support for a call to exterminate the Indian, to actually create bounties for the killing of Dakota. This kind of dichotomy seemed to be very common among many of the liberals. Not all political liberals felt this way, but a significant number did. And Wilkinson pretty much gave voice to that.
Yeah, I found that very interesting, just how adamant Wilkinson and like Swisshelm were against the Dakota, meanwhile fighting for the rights of free blacks that had just recently been emancipated. Can you talk more about the Dakota War? You start the book off focusing, highlighting the U.S.-Dakota War, and I wonder, why did you choose to include so much of that into the book?
Well, I thought that the main purpose of this book was to try to understand what Lincoln Republicans were like in Minnesota. I wanted to try to understand whether the sensibilities of Minnesota's children of Lincoln was similar to that experienced by their brethren in other parts of the North and other parts of the country towards African Americans. And in getting that sense, I felt like I wanted to get as wide a range as possible of those who identified themselves as Lincoln Republicans. One of the people I selected was a man who was an Irish Protestant immigrant who lived in Le Sueur County. His name was Thomas Montgomery, and he lived on a farm at the time the Dakota rose up. And so his story becomes yet another chapter to me understanding the sensibilities of the Lincoln Republicans of Minnesota. Montgomery was would later become a member of would soon become a member of the army that was assigned the task of defeating and capturing the Dakota. He would be a part of the expeditionary force that Henry Sibley led, and in 1863. By the way, I might say that Montgomery was on duty at the time of the hangings of the 38 Dakota men in Mankato. He was, if you see a depiction, and that's a fairly common, you can find that image of soldiers ringing the scaffolding where the Dakota men were hung. He was one of the soldiers on guard at the time, and he actually writes about it in his letters, which can be acquired at the Historical Society. When he returned to Fort Snelling, his unit was deployed to St. Louis. And in St. Louis, he learned for the first time of the colored troops, infantry troops, and he also realized that this could be his avenue to becoming an officer and a gentleman. And so he transferred into that unit. So he becomes a white man leading black troops. And you could see through his letters not only his attitudes and sometimes ambivalent attitudes towards the Dakota, you could see it and compare his attitudes towards the Indians with his attitudes of the African Americans who he led. He would at one time be impressed with their determination to fight for their freedom, and on the other hand, view them as inferiors to himself. So I think that for the most part, I think that his story fleshes out or gives yet another dimension of that Lincoln Republican sensibility in Minnesota. He would later be supportive of his troopers purchasing land in southwestern Minnesota. Because he learned or realized that that would be a controversial thing in his neighborhood, that a number of the whites who lived in his region were not happy about seeing blacks become homesteaders there, he basically let the plan drop. And much later, when he gets out of the army, he becomes a person who began to buy and sell real estate to the new homesteaders coming in from the East and from Europe. And he basically does nothing to help his black troopers either move to Minnesota or those who did move to Minnesota purchase land. I saw that as another dimension of the Lincoln Republic and another source, another form of abandonment of their black charges.
You've talked about Thomas Montgomery now and earlier about Morton Wilkinson. There are two other whites that you highlight in this book, but before we get to them, can you talk a little bit about what you mean by the children of Lincoln? I know that came from a quote from Frederick Douglass. Why did he say that, and why did you choose to use that as the title of your novel, or book, I'm sorry?
Well, the time, well, in 1876, the Emancipation Memorial was dedicated in Washington, D.C. Perhaps many of your listeners are familiar with the visage of that memorial. So it has Lincoln standing on the pedestal with both arms outstretched, and at his knees is a freedman, a freed slave, African American slave, huddled, forever bowed. And even though the chains around his arms have been broken so that he is free in that regard, he is forever frozen in that posture of subordination to the emancipator. He will never be able to stand up and face the emancipator as an equal to the emancipator. That becomes sort of a symbol of how white liberals in the late 19th century viewed the African American. You know, we freed you, we made you politically equal, but you can never be equal to us in any kind of fundamental way. And Frederick Douglass, who was one of the few speakers of the day to dedicate the monument, gives this very long speech about how great Abraham Lincoln was, and he was. Mm-hmm. But he also says to the audience, which was largely white, you, he's talking to the white audience, were the children of Lincoln. We, referring to African Americans, were at best his stepchildren. It's the only time that he makes that kind of reference, but I think in that short phrase, he basically characterizes the nature of race relations, the nature of the relationship between whites and blacks, but not just whites and blacks, white friends of black people and black people, that kind of strange and unique form of paternalism. He characterizes that in that phrase. And I thought that phrase best characterizes the dynamic that I wanted to explore. How is it that the friends of black people could basically be complacent to the spread and the deepening policies of Jim Crow in the North and in the South, and white supremacy in particular in the South? How could they be complacent to that after they had sacrificed so much during the Civil War? One additional thing, in the year that the monument was dedicated, this is 1876, that was also the year of a presidential election in which Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican candidate, ran against the Democratic candidate, Samuel Tilden, who was governor of New York. And in the Electoral College, both candidates had the same number of votes. It was a tie. Rutherford B. Hayes was able to get the majority by persuading Southern Democrats to vote against their own candidate and to support him, a Republican. And he said that if you support me, the first act I will do once elected president is to remove the troops from the South and therefore hand over complete control of Southern race relations to you. He was given those votes. He was true to his word to the Southern Democrats. He removed the federal troops from the South. And that act basically ended Reconstruction. But at the same time, it also gave a green light to white supremacists to step up its campaign of terror against the African American. And all of this is happening while Republicans control both the House, the Senate, and the presidency.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I think the Children of Lincoln kind of characterizes that whole thing.
Sure. So let's talk about the other two whites or Children of Lincoln or Friends of Blacks, as you call them, in this book. I believe Sarah Berger Stearns and Daniel D. Merrill. Can you tell us a little bit about them and why you used them in this book?
Sure. Sarah Berger Stearns was a fascinating person. I mean, they're all fascinating, but she especially was. I wanted to have a woman activist. I wanted to hear her voice in this story. And I found her voice through the strangest way. I happened to pull up a copy of the Rochester Post, which was a newspaper published in Rochester in 1866. It was a two-page newspaper, but it was the only paper coming out of Rochester at that time. And I found on the second page, in a very, very small box, less than an inch, an article about incest. In the next issue, I found an article about, you know, in the same size article, I found a piece written on rape and on childbirth and on other topics that you don't normally associate with newspapers during the Victorian age, you know, during that time, mid-19th century, let alone in outstate Minnesota. You just don't associate newspapers of that time covering something as delicate and as indiscreet as rape and spousal abuse and murder. You don't read stories like that. So I wanted to know who was writing these stories. And I learned that it was Sarah Berger Stearns, who at the time was living in Rochester. She had come from Michigan. She wanted to, at 16, to enter the University of Michigan for study, and she was denied entrance, as you can imagine, on the basis of her gender. But what made her unique in my mind was not that she would have the audacity to enroll or seek to enroll, but that in the face of her rejection, she sued the University of Michigan on the basis of discrimination. This is a 16-year-old girl, you know, in the 1850s. She married Ozora Stearns, who was also an officer. He's a white guy. He was an officer in the colored regiment. And in 1866, they moved to Rochester, Minnesota, where Ozora would soon become county attorney. And Stearns began her career as a journalist. So you think of a person on the frontier. You know, at this time, there is no Highway 35. She is isolated. many months of the year in this one horse town, I guess is what people would call it, Rochester, Minnesota. And from there, she began to write about women's rights. And in particular, she was becoming increasingly critical of the Republicans who refused to include women's suffrage while they campaigned for black suffrage. She supported the ratification of the 13th Amendment and reluctantly supported the 14th Amendment, but had what became more militant when she saw the reluctance on the part, no, I should say the resistance on the part of the party leadership and removing the word male from the proposal of the 14th Amendment and later the 15th Amendment that would therefore exclude women from citizenship at that time and from voting rights in the 15th Amendment. So she became much more vocal in her frustration of the party elite. And her frustration began to take the form of criticizing white men who were more willing to give the vote to black men, many of whom could not vote, some of whom could be accused of being abusive of their wives, while not giving the right to vote to their own wives, their own daughters, their own their mothers, their aunts or sisters. She felt that that was rank hypocrisy. And so as she began to increasingly attack the Republican leadership, she also began to take shots at the wretched nature of African-American men. So you have this rather unfortunate situation where a political liberal and a supporter of Lincoln and a supporter of emancipation, through her frustration at not being able to get support for women's suffrage, becoming much more critical of black men who were being placed above her, in effect, even though they were not as educated as she was. This was the nature of her frustration. And it was a frustration that was mirrored by Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton as well, at about the same time. So you have this paradox where they're beginning to embrace the racism of Democrats who had been their enemies not too long before. This sort of unholy, I don't know if unholy is the appropriate term, but it was an unfortunate alliance that many of the suffragists during this time felt they needed to form in order to have a political base, because their own former allies in the Republican leadership had rejected their call for women's suffrage. Mm-hmm. I think that that was another example of at least, another class that would be considered Lincoln Republicans. Susan B. Anthony in particular, Elizabeth Cady Stanton were basically declaring war, in effect, against African Americans when they were confronted with their white allies. I'm sorry, their abolitionists and Republican allies, white males, who were saying this was the Negro hour, and the relationship that she, Susan B. Anthony, had with Frederick Douglass would forever be tense for the remainder of the 19th century. Would forever be tense because the things that they said about each other would not permit the relationship to heal. Well, that is in effect mirrored in Sarah Berger Stearns for the remainder of the 1860s, as her campaign to increase the support for women's suffrage began to spread. You began to see a more class-oriented situation where professional women, middle-class white women, were drawn to the suffrage movement. African-American women were excluded from it, and black men came to view her work as a source of hostility, because oftentimes Sarah Berger Stearns would use articles illustrating why black men could never be equal to white women They would use she would use articles mirroring, she would print articles that appeared in the Democratic newspaper of black men raping white women. So you have this liberal basically adopting a much more critical view of black men out of the frustration of being betrayed by her one-time allies. I think that that's another example of how the liberals and the political liberals in the second half of the 19th century began to shift their attention away from the welfare of African Americans. Mm-hmm. How former friends ceased to become friends.
Do you think Stearns then did support black suffrage and black rights, or was she only interested in women's suffrage and women's rights?
Oh, I think she was initially quite supportive of black rights. I mean, she, like other suffragists of her camp, saw it as an issue of universal suffrage. You know, they used the phrase universal suffrage, that this was not just a thing of black suffrage and women's suffrage, but all adults, you know, all citizens should have the right to vote. Mm-hmm. It should not be distinguished by gender. But when her former friends in the Republican Party said this was the Negro hour, and in Minnesota especially, when her former friends, many of whom who were friends of her husband and political allies of her husband, used the most vile language to condemn and to vilify women suffragists, she began to become equally angry with the white males who led the party, and began to see this as something that, you know, you can't rely on the Republican Party to bring. So whereas before they were in favor of universal suffrage, she began to see how race was the excuse that the established party used to keep women in their place. And so she became, her sentiment, her rhetoric began to reflect that frustration that race was being used against her. If race can be a tool to put me down, then I will become contemptuous of that tool, seemed to be where she was, her attitude of the day.
So who then was Daniel D. Merrill, and what role did he play in all of this?
Daniel Merrill was, I consider him the man in the shadows. He's interesting in a different way. He was a Republican. When he moved here from Michigan, he settled in St. Paul. He was he was one of the earliest members of the First Baptist Church in St. Paul, which was a church where a lot of the community leadership attended. He had access to a lot of powerful people in St. Paul. He was a Republican, and he did campaign for Lincoln. In a Democratic city, he was also a businessman who was very practical. St. Paul was a Democratic stronghold, and in order for him to be a successful businessman, he had to be able to negotiate the rapids of politics, partisan politics. And in his case, that meant that he was going to minimize his Republican identity in order to establish the type of rapport he needed with the political Democrat power elite of the city, both in terms of business and in terms of politics. So he tended to, as he became more successful in a business sense, he became less outwardly Republican in the political sense. He wanted to get along with people. He wanted to, advance his own interests. In 1865, 66, 67, he began to work with Robert Hickman, who was a former slave of Missouri, who left Missouri in 63, moved to St. Paul, and he wanted to start a church. And because he identified with the Baptist church, he was encouraged to approach the First Baptist Church of St. Paul's, the white church, in an effort to try to ask for help from them to get his church started. And Merrill was the person who the deacons of the church assigned, in effect, to work with Hickman. Merrill knew who the bankers were. He knew who the political people were. He understood how to move an agenda forward of this nature. He negotiated land deals in behalf of the church. The interesting thing about this was not just his support, but he also embodied the interest of the denomination, of the Baptist Association, which requires the minister to be approved by the congregation, but then they have to be approved by the association in order for them to be ordained. So you had in Robert Hickman, the black man, a situation where as a slave, he could preach to his flock. But now in Minnesota, as a free man, he could not preach to his flock because he was not ordained. And so for the longest time, Hickman kind of followed the lead of Merrill in order to ingratiate himself with the White Baptist Association. Now, Merrill was able to get the church going. He was able to get the structure built. He was able to get the tools for it. He was able to get the funding for it, but he also did little to help Hickman become the minister of the church. So you have the situation where the black congregation did not have its choice to lead them. Mm-hmm. The person who would become the pastor of the church would be none other than the father-in-law of Merrill, who was looking for a job. So Merrill put his own father-in-law in this black church. His father-in-law is a Scottish immigrant, had no experience with African Americans, had no experience with the emotionalistic kind of form of religious expression that African Americans of this group displayed. But he needed a church, and so he was placed in charge. And for the most part, Reverend Talbert, who was the minister, would remain in charge of the church. I see that as an example, not so much, the appointment of his father-in-law. That's a manifestation of a deeper thing. The more important element that comes from this particular case study is the fact that Hickman could not have a conversation with Merrill. Hickman could not express his frustration because Hickman was worried that Merrill would see Hickman as being ungrateful for all that Merrill had done for him. And this was a common theme among the children of Lincoln and their black friends. They could call each other friends, but that word should be encased in quotation marks, that there was no equity between the two people. Seldom were children of Lincoln, the white children of Lincoln, in a position where they actually had blacks who were their friends. They didn't even really know blacks on a personal level, but they had this sort of sense of blacks as an abstract. Black people were an abstraction. They were the slaves who had been freed. They were this freedman on the statue that would be commemorated years later in 1876. But in that situation, blacks could never really be candid with their white patrons. Blacks were constrained from not only being appeared to be ungrateful, but they were constrained by the concern of not wanting to alienate patrons who could abandon them, in which case they would have nothing. And so blacks basically learned to live quietly in a parallel world. And then, in essence, is what my book is about, is exploring the nuanced relationships between one class of Minnesotans who had a right to feel like they had done, noble deeds. They had done noble deeds, mm-hmm. but that they rested on those laurels as a way of avoiding forming the kind of relationship that would allow them to be challenged, you know, by people who they now said were equal to them. So that's basically, I mean, his Merrill story, I think, illustrates that. Stearns gives another example of that. Montgomery's relationship with African Americans is another form of paternalism, and so on and so forth. These are four different people who don't really know each other, but they are very similar in their backgrounds. They're very similar in their attitude towards African Americans, even though they come to African Americans from different avenues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you give a good summary there. You mentioned in your epilogue that none of these four white children of Lincoln were at the unveiling of the statue in 1876. So what did that represent as far as this book goes?
Well, I think it represents the just how far removed they had grown from the original reason for their crusade in the Civil War. It was a noble effort that they engaged in to, first of all, keep the Union together, and then to free all men. And then after that, in Minnesota's case, across the North, to make African Americans, politically equal to white people. This is something that no one really expected the war would be about at the beginning of the war. So it was an amazing thing that they were able to achieve. But within a few short years, each one of them came to feel a little skeptical about whether there should be more done to even symbolize concern for the African American. In the case of Wilkinson, for example, he became quite critical of the Republican Party for being a party of corruption and using the violence in the South between the Klan and white Republicans and Black Republicans. He blamed the Republican Party for fomenting that frustration. By virtue of having an occupying force in the South, you're basically exacerbating tensions between the two regions, and you're doing it cynically. He accused the Republicans of basically fanning the flames of sectional violence as a way of keeping voters distracted from the failings of the party to meet the needs of Northern voters. The bloody shirt, in other words, became the term that was commonly used against the Republican Party. The bloody shirt was like the muleta that you see the matador use to misdirect bull. Mm-hmm. In this case, the bull were the voters. We will distract them from the economic policies that are failing. We'll distract them from the social tensions that are increasing. We'll distract them from the concentration of wealth. We'll distract them by reminding them of what the Klan is doing in the South. We don't want to be held accountable for our failed policy. This seems to be where people like Wilkinson and other people like him were feeling towards the Republican Party. And so any discussion about civil rights, any discussion about the welfare of Blacks was viewed, the black social political welfare was basically, and social welfare was viewed as a strand with a fiber in that bloody shirt. It was just one of the things meant to distract white voters from what the real problems were with the party in power. And so, going to the memorial, in effect, would have been giving tribute to a party that had lost its moorings, lost its virtue. I think this is where a number of the Lincoln Republicans that I looked at were coming from. And it got the commemoration of that monument got very little coverage in the Republican newspapers in Minnesota, and none of the people who I mentioned uttered a word about it. It just was irrelevant. Within a short period of time, they had become that contemptuous of the issues that had compelled them just 10 years before.
That's really very interesting. I'm really quite fascinated with the whole book itself and how you're able to sort of sift through the political context and that of Reconstruction and the Civil War and many different things going on at that time. I wonder what parallels there are to today in our fight for equal rights and equal opportunity. How does this book resonate with what's going on in society today?
Well, I'll tell you, Colin, I think that fundamentally this book illustrates what happens when people who rely on their laurels lose sight of the purpose for those laurels. You know, when they become complacent to past good deeds, to having committed past good deeds, that's the first step to seeing those good deeds begin to erode. Mm-hmm. I think that in the past several years, looking at the political situation of America today, when you look at the election of 2016, I think there are a lot of people who had supported, the policies, at least, of President Obama and the Democratic Party, and who may consider themselves independents but supportive of liberal measures or at least moderate measures. There was a sense that after Obama, because things will not be the same, or because they're upset with certain, the stakes fell. They were not as significant. That there was a disbelief that there could be any sort of retrenchment, because what we achieved during those previous 8 years could never be reversed. And I think that as a result, people woke up over the past 2 years, shocked at how much has been rolled back, and how easily, relatively speaking, it happened. So I think that the lesson that I take from this book, as it relates to today, is that one can never be complacent to one's successes. That no matter how ennoble, the crusade is that you led or participated in, even if you have won, the fruits of victory, can decay very easily, and oftentimes right in front of your eyes, if you're distracted, if you're looking elsewhere. And I feel that's something that we are beginning to recognize today. I think that if you look at such things as universal health care, it wasn't until it was threatened that people began to recognize how significant that is to the quality of our society. And you can come up with any number of other issues that we're seeing being rolled back now. 2 years ago, we didn't think that was going to happen. We thought that was secure. But anything can roll back once you begin to take the foot off the gas, once you begin to feel that, we've done our part.
Sure.
So I think that's really the moral of the book itself, that good deeds have to be reinforced continuously, that has to be a constant priority of society to perpetuate, that it always has to be about the quality of the welfare of all of our citizens. That always has to be preeminent. You can't be distracted from whatever. You can't begin to. So anyway, that's what I think the book is about for the most part. And it's the reason why I wrote it.
Well, I'm glad you did. And I think that's very true and very well stated. I know you just released this book in the last month or two, so I'm sure you're promoting it at the moment, but what else are you working on?
Well, I have a couple other projects, one dealing with the origins of political liberalism in Minnesota, which in a sense begins in 1847 and goes up to 1860. But in looking at some of the people who would become the political liberals of the state and basically define political liberalism for the state, I go back even further to the beginning of the century where their lives began, to kind of get a sense of why in Minnesota, why isn't Wisconsin, for example, or Illinois, or why aren't other northern states, why do they not have the reputation of political exceptionalism that we have? And this book attempts to examine what it is about Minnesota where that could happen, why it happened. The other book that I'm working on, and actually it's the one that has my heart at this moment, is a biography of Nellie Francis, African-American woman, St. Paul, who she lived in from 1870 to about 1960. She was very active, African-American woman, was very active in just about every single civil rights issue that occurred nationally as well as locally. She participated in one of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement in Minnesota, was a lieutenant of Clara Ulin, who was kind of a leader of the women's suffrage movement. And within a week or so after the certificate of ratification for the 19th Amendment was signed by Governor Bernquist, in Duluth, three black men were lynched. And she basically wrote the legislation that would later be approved by the legislature in 1920. She wrote the legislation that made lynching a crime. She was an exceptional person. No one knows anything about her. And she's been sort of the focus of my attention for the past year or so. So I'm kind of working on two books at the same time.
And you've got plenty to keep you busy.
Plenty to keep me busy. That's right. That are my students.
Sure. So for readers, where can they find your book and where can they find more information about you and your work?
Well, the book is published by the University of Minnesota Press, and I believe it's Amazon, but the press is a good place to begin. I believe there are copies over at the Historical Society as well. And so, you know, that as far as I know is how to, this is really bad promotion, I suppose, but you can start with Amazon and University of Minnesota Press to find the books.
Sure.
So,
well, I've been speaking with Dr. William Green. He's the author of The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. Dr. Green, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed meeting with you and talking about this book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.